This audio is a recording of a Better Questions discussion in Chelmsbury in February of 2010. The speakers are Paddy Bresnahan and Alessandro Zagato, and they'll be discussing the ideas of Jacques Lanser and Alain Bourdon. The discussion was organised by Better Questions, which is an initiative that has emerged out of conversations between people engaged in either social movement practices in Dublin and or thought on radical social change. They have a blog at thought-movements.blogspot.com.
The seminar series, the kind of objective behind it, or the motivation for it, was a recognition that a lot of the concepts that we work with on the radical left, or thinking about radical social transformation, are in something of a crisis, or at least they're no longer seem to allow us to radically critique the forms of power and exploitation and so on that are proliferating all around us. So we decided to basically put together a series of seminars to develop some new, or to try and introduce and start to discuss some different ways of conceptualising these issues, which might change the way we think about politics. And the two theorists that we're going to be talking about today that will be discussed by Alessandro and Paddy are certainly two theorists that we would strongly associate with an interrogation of the classical concepts of the radical left, and an attempt to reframe them in ways which allow us to consider thinking about emancipation in the 21st century. So I won't say anything else about it because these guys will say plenty. They'll speak for around 40 minutes and then we'll have a chance to discuss. So
to start with, I would like to say that we are not philosophers, but we are just readers, researchers and militants that think it is necessary to explore new theoretical perspectives, especially in a phase in which many of the conventional certainties around politics and emancipation have collapsed. And in fact, we live in a really reactionary time. On one hand, the political experiences of the last century seems to be exhausted, completely saturated. On the other hand, every rare form of political intensity ends up being neutralized by the unlimited power of the status quo. So this suspension of the political is reflected in both the reduction of the state to a mere police agent servicing the capital and the worrying return of identitarian fanaticism. So what is striking, we think, for the time being is not just the arrogance of the empire, of capitalism, or whatever you want to call it, but even more the weakness of the alternative to it. We think that in order to understand this colossal paralysis, it is extremely important not to underestimate the last worldwide political sequence. Indeed, the 60s and the 70s were a time where a lot of new political subjectivities emerged, organizing outside traditional frameworks like parties, unions, and most remarkably, outside the Communist Party, which is to say, the vanguard of the working class. Although those movements introduced a lot of innovation, they also left us with many unsolved problems. A political imperative today is to be extremely cautious about analyzing those ruptures only through conventional Marxist interpretation, especially if we consider that with the end of the last century, Marxism showed its inability to make claims upon history, and this is really evident today after the financial crisis. Politics, this is the first assumption for Badiou and Rancière, no longer has an historical component. And even worse, history is not at all oriented toward the progressive liquidation of passivity. This, by the way, doesn't mean to be anti-Marxist. Indeed, what Badiou and Rancière propose here is not to repeat, but to reinvent over and over again the founding gesture of the Communist Manifesto. So this gesture consisted in interpreting the event that were the uprising of the 1840s with the hypothesis of an unprecedented political capacity. So what we need to grasp today is exactly the reappearance of that specter that Marx referred to in the manifesto, but in this new and probably unexpected form. We need to have the courage to think again and to be politically experimental. So we really hope that our presentation can be of inspiration for those people who already read something of Badiou and Rancière, but also for those who didn't. In any case, it is addressed to those comrades that didn't give up the ideas of justice and emancipation of the humanity. Although today it is difficult even to imagine a way out of the actual impasse, it is from this bottom level that everything needs to start again. And it's from this necessity of rethinking politics and reinvent it, that we will start this presentation of the militant talk of Badiou and Rancière.
I suppose I'm going to start by echoing things that Mick began with and Alessandro then went on to talk about. And I think there'll be quite a lot of maybe or hopefully not repetition, but maybe resonance, because the way we're going to present it is that Alessandro will speak and I'll speak, and then Alessandro will speak and I'll speak, because as we wrote these, both of us maybe had our interest in one of these thinkers more than the other, but as we came together and wrote them, you know, it's very obvious that there's lots of overlaps, and this idea of resonance of these ideas certainly isn't a bad or an unproductive thing. But to maybe trace or illustrate the trajectory that they were both talking about that happened since 68 and has to happen with the impasse that we see, there was two quotes that I thought I'd begin with. The first one is by Marx in 1845, a very well-known quote by the in the Feuerbach thesis, which is that philosophers have only interpreted the world in various ways. The point is to change it. And Rancière, about 150 years after that, wrote, "Philosophers have interpreted the world. The point is to interpret it again." And that gives some sense of this idea that we have to move beyond an idea of emancipation or politics or subjectivity or political actors as being in any way objective, or kind of this historical unfolding or determinism. To give some background to Rancière's trajectory or biography, he was, as Badiou, they were both part of the 68 generation. They were both students of Louis Althusser. Rancière wrote a book with Althusser. And then in the early 70s, he was in his early 20s, and this, I suppose, giving more strength to the idea of Rancière's and Badiou's constant demand that there is this re-questioning and reinterpretation and always opening out and not enclosing in or making any prescriptive judgments. He broke with essentially Althusser's idea that, and this was echoing common, I suppose, socialist teaching of some kind of intellectual avant-garde, a Leninist principle, intellectual avant-garde, and a mass of workers who were existing through false consciousness. And this divide between some kind of knowledge and some kind of ignorance, Rancière has constantly through his work tried to overturn and create as his starting point or point of departure of any politics the idea that equality is a universal starting point, never an aspiration, and never should be an aspiration. And what I'd like to present, and I think what we're both going to be presenting, is as much as possible trying to give some form to these central ideas of, first of all, an idea of the state or policy or a consensus, a status quo, which is occupied with determining things. I mean, that's not just the state as we know of capitalism, that's also orthodox communism and many different types of ideology. This idea of determining things and limiting things before they themselves can fulfill some potential. maybe articulate that better, the idea that capitalism is some kind of unfolding of progress, or idea of socialism as being another type of unfolding of time. They try not to define any political actor before it has defined itself. I'm going to talk about that. I'm going to talk about how politics is the break with that consensus, and then finish up or discuss this idea of equality. This idea of equality is a universal principle and not an aspiration. So I'll pass you back to Alessandro.
Okay, so politics is a central notion in Badiou, and his aim is to reestablish its existence, he says, I'm quoting, to the point of its apparent impossibility, that is the actual situation. To do so, he introduces the idea that there is the necessity of new forms of experimentation, which are alternative, of course, to the election, to the bureaucratic competition for power, and in general, they are alternative to the state and its designation. And this is an essential point in Badiou. Although in common sense there is a tendency to consider politics and the state as being more or less equivalent, a fundamental difference should be stressed here. In Badiou's perspective, politics is rare. It exists only in singular inventive sequences, whereas the state, despite the constant historical mutation of its forms, is a structural invariance. It works essentially as a representation that consists in the hierarchical categorization of human beings. Rancière, as we will say later, would call it distribution of roles and functions. So to be clear, I've made a little scheme here. Every situation, and we can imagine the set A, is the presentation of itself. Let's think about Ireland, of the people that compose it, and of the elements that belong to it. The same situation is also given as a state that this is the process. So this is more or less the process. It's given as a state that is the internal configuration of the parts or of its subsets, and therefore as a representation. The state, this is the meaning of this, does not recognize the single elements as independent beings, but just includes them as belonging to multiple subgroups. So the authority of the state over the simply presented situation A is based on the mathematical fact that there is always more parts, more subsets than elements. This is to say that the representative multiplicity of the state is always of a higher power than the presentative multiplicity. So to do an example, the elements of the Irish national set can be grouped in the same way according to the subset of taxpayers, prison inmates, registered voters, employed workers, teachers, unemployed, single mothers, students, HIV-positive people, and so on. Of course, then, a single individual can belong to several of these subsets, as we see there in the example. For example, you can be an unemployed, Dublin one-born, single mother. But all this predication that the state uses to categorize you in the perspective of Badiou is to hierarchically dispose you in group, to include you or to exclude you, as, for example, could be the outsider subset of an illegal migrant. However, this predication do not say anything about the substantial complexity of an individual, say, any single mother, as a living and as a thinking person. This is very briefly, there is a big chapter in Badiou about this state of the situation. This is really a synopsis of it. But this is the question of power of Badiou. It's presentation and representation. So the state, and consequently also the economy that today is the norm of the state, are characterized by a structural effect of separation and superpower to regard to what is simply presented in the situation. So, Badiou's groundbreaking assumption is that our politics, to be effectively egalitarian or emancipatory, needs to be heterogeneous with any form of representation. Therefore, it cannot be derived from objective state-defined conditions such as the market, family, opinion polls, election, class composition, unions, parties, and so on. Politics breaks with all this chain of empty representation by introducing subjective elements that are impossible to represent. They can be neither included not excluded. But to achieve this, tells Aspadil, it is absolutely necessary to put the state at a distance. Now, in normal conditions, we know that it is really difficult to distance oneself from the state. Indeed, its representational power is erratic. It permeates our life with infinite rituals and bounds. Imagine things about a labor, family, your education, your skills, your image toward the other people. So when in a society there is no egalitarian politics, there is no politics that breaks totally with the state is so rooted in people's lives that a distance seems to be impossible. This deep identification with the state's domination that is really actual is the source of the feeling that we have today to be such in a suffocating limbo, that there is no alternative. Now, in order to interrupt this, as Badiou say, enslavement of the parts of the situation, something needs to happen. Even for just a moment, and in a small scale, something impossible to represent has to pop in the situation. And the name, as I will tell later, Badiou gives to this element is event.
And what?
Event.
So, Rancière makes this very important distinction, as Badiou does, between politics and the state. Rancière calls it politics and policy, or policy understood as policing, which is essentially, in Badiou's terms, the state, which, to quote Rancière, entails creating community consent which relies on the distribution of shares and the hierarchy of places and functions. And again, echoing Badiou, it's not some kind of superstructure. It's how we come to perceive and experience the world ourselves. So we aren't in any way you know, just pawns being moved around. We are embodying this particular type of consensus all the time. The difference is, one of the differences between Badiou and Rancière is that Rancière understands this distribution of roles and functions as a distribution based on time and place. It's what he calls politics aesthetics. So where something is located at a particular time, at a particular place, it fits, it's appropriate. When something leaves its appropriate time and place, it becomes disruptive. So as a small example, when workers first left the factory where they were supposed to be workers and they walked on the streets, that wasn't disruptive purely because it upset traffic and police had to come out and put them back into the factory. It was disruptive because... And it's difficult for us to understand, but it's political and properly disruptive because it creates a different subject. It asserts a different type. It asserts a proletarian as opposed to a worker. A worker is just in a factory working, supposed to be incapable of doing anything other than working. So when they leave the factory, their designated place and their designated time, and they start walking in the streets, it's properly political because some new type of arrangement has been happened, some new seizure or some new creation of a time and a place. And I think that the importance of that, it's quite difficult to grasp because when you look at it retrospectively, I mean, it's not so uncommon for people to walk on the streets now, and the radicality of it on this level of subjectivity is quite difficult to bring home, because Ranciere as an example of this, Ranciere talks about the way in which this type of maintenance of consensus isn't just the state, government, NGOs, whatever you want to call it. It's also, and increasingly, and this is his great worry about the left and the apathy of the left, it's something that critical theorists do a lot. So the protests that were in the banlieues in Paris about 4 years ago, which caused that big riot, and you know, there was for a number of days and weeks there was this sort of anarchy in this area outside Paris. That was understood afterwards by obviously by the far right and the right and the state as some kind of aberration, as some kind of just Arabs or non-French people just acting up. But people on the left also interpreted it as some kind of explosion of individualism and greed, and
that the reason why these young Arabs had caused trouble and unrest was because of a false desire for more things, a consumerist desire for clothes and cars, and not therefore the expression of something else, something potentially destabilizing. And this is how the police operates.
By depoliticizing. Yeah. Okay, I'll just mention this because it's if I don't mention it now, I'll have to mention it later. Ranciere talks about, and this will lead into the section on politics, Ranciere talks about the part with no part, which is, it kind of mirrors Badger's idea of the excess. And this excess is that which it doesn't fit inside the consensus, as I've talked about. It's something which can't be counted. So if you imagine it even as a social body, which is often the metaphor that's used of some kind of social organizational community, it's that which doesn't have a function that's identified. So it's not, and this is very important, it's not a group that is just marginalized in society. So it's not, it can't be reduced to sort of identitarian politics, it can't be reduced to a community, to something that's calling for a particular right or a particular access to certain services. It's something which has no name. And I'll give the example that Ranciere uses as a very vital or illustrative point in the history of the last 200 years of communism. Auguste Blanqui was a revolutionary in France in the 1820s and 30s, and he was brought to court for subversive activity. And the magistrate asked him what his profession was, and he said his profession was proletarian. And it was the first time this word had been used in a sort of public sphere, I suppose. And the clerk looked down his list, and this obviously wasn't listed on the jobs that he'd been given. It wasn't a butcher, a carpenter, a painter, a factory worker. So the clerk said, "I'm afraid it's not down here. You're not a proletarian. That's not a profession." And Blanqui responded by saying, "It's the profession of 30 million Frenchmen who live off their labour and don't have any political rights." And what he was asserting was that there was this group that had no way of having a representation because they couldn't be located or nominalized. They couldn't be reduced to a particular set of criteria, a particular set of roles and functions, like being what Alessandro was talking about, these certain tags that are put on people. It was something beyond that. And Blanqui talked about how it was a profession of faith as opposed to a profession which was about your particular function. And that's the best example, and it's Ranciere's example of what he means by this part with no part, the excess. So I'll finish up there.
So this part with no part that he's talking about in Badiou is the event. He supposes that, he argues that every singular political procedure has its origin in an event, I'm quoting, something must happen in order for that to be something new. Even in our personal life, if we think, for something to change, there must be an encounter, there must be something which cannot be predicted or managed, and which is based only on chance. The really powerful effect an event can have depends from the fact that it exposes the situation to what it is, to pure inconsistency, to pure equality of the subjectivities, which is a starting point, as Pani said. In its very importance, an event is not the realization of a potentiality that resides inside the situation. It is rather the creation of a new possibility. This possibility, then, can develop into a political procedure only through the military intervention of those who are committed to the event. This is the meaning of subjectivation in Baudelaire. It is a decision, not more than an effect or a consequence. Accordingly, in politics, the event can be thought as the eruption of a socially indeterminable element that undermines the prevailing regime of distribution of roles and function as a whole. So, for instance, were the first industrial worker uprisings for Marx.
People's unprecedented decision to stop working and leave the factories was the eruption of an impossible element in the new industrial society, a proletarian political capacity, which at the time was general and not yet Marxist.
The same way, as Ronit Lentin showed us some weeks ago, migrants occupy today the absent center of the current debates about Ireland as a political and economic community. Now our question is, how will their subjective eruption look like? This is difficult to say, because the event comes unexpected, opening an uncertain space in a way where action is undertaken at the level of non-representation. So this is why politics is so inventive and so dangerous. Its aim is to make seem possible what in the situation is considered to be illogical and impossible. For example, that in a society no one is illegal. Or, for example, resistance during fascism. If resistance had to wait for a referendum or for objective condition to be developed, Italy probably would still be fascist. But by the same token, before May 68, in the name of the dominant class conception of politics, it was considered to be illogical that students and workers could develop together, that factories and universities could be coextensive political sites. And also, before the Chinese Cultural Revolution, this is another example, the formation of independent communist political organization in a state that was already communist was considered to be illogical, so impossible. So independent students and workers were accused to be the betrayers of the working class at the time. Yet, this didn't prevent the historical identification of emancipation and party which is representative of the working class to fall apart. So it is clear that the political event is what the state tends to avoid. Whereas the state tries to make one, as we see, to keep together its subsets, the event presents itself as a pure splitting, as a pure disidentification. Before the event, the situation is ruled by the unity of consensus on what concerns the identification of elements with their situational place. So, as Paddy said, a worker is a worker, and everyone agrees on that, like unions agree, right-wing parties, the left, the state, a worker is a worker. After the event, a new possibility breaks in. To become a militant subject, says Badiou, is, in the name of equality, to try to make the most of an open possibility. We also know that when emancipation starts, when an emancipatory procedure starts, the state reacts showing its repressive apparatuses. The police, the courts, the prison, that are all those machineries that sustain this representation system. However, repression is not the only reactive element in the situation, because political militants have also to confront those depoliticized organizations which, seeing the event as a threat for their own existence, think about the Communist Party in China or the Communist Party in Italy during the 60s, either deny the political possibility the event open, for example, student and worker to organize together, or try to interpret it in the light of their own cultural references, so alienation or some other explanation. It is the same, for example, of these members, of these union members, trying, in Paris was really clear in May 68, to separate the students and the independent workers. What they didn't understand is that a political situation is always marked by a surplus of subjectivity with regard of the surrounding political culture. Whatever political culture it is, can be Marxist, capitalist, neoliberal, whatever.
So again, the same sort of concepts and same kind of ideas, but I think that it's a good thing that we're going over and overlapping quite a lot. Rancière writes that politics, which is this opposition or the opposing process to policy or consensus, that politics is first and foremost an intervention upon the visible and the sayable. And he literally means that. When he talks about the politics of aesthetics, it's literally about what is heard as an argument, what's heard as something that's reasonable, as opposed to being heard as just shouts, or like the bananas in France, just being some anarchic, just impossibility. So the example would be police breaking up a demonstration and getting, you know, passers-by to go past, and they say, oh, there's nothing to see here, just go along about your business, there's nothing to see. It's literally, this is just an aberration, keep on circulating. So politics is about this challenge, this event, which has to be a disruption. It's a disruption because it's the encountering of two different processes, two different worlds. One which wants to count the world in a certain way, and one which wants to count it in a different way. One which says there is something here, and one which says there's nothing here. So it's inevitably a clash. He writes, the essence of politics is dissensus. Dissensus is not the confrontation between interests or opinions, as it might be explained in parliament or in parliamentary democracy. It is a manifestation of a distance of the sensible from itself. Politics makes visible that which had no reason to be seen. Yet political argument is at one and the same time the demonstration of a possible world where the argument could count as argument, addressed by a subject qualified to argue, upon an identified object, to an addressee who is required to see the object and to hear the argument that he or she normally has no reason to either see or hear. It is the construction of a paradoxical world that relates two separate worlds. And this process of politics amounts to emancipation for Rancière. And this is now to introduce this idea of equality, which is central to Rancière. This moment of rupture or of the political is, even if it happens in a specific case, in a specific way, it is the assertion of a universal equality. It's the moment in which the worker says, I am also intelligent, I can also think and realize myself, and I don't need some intellectual ideologue to explain to me the objective conditions of emancipation. So, for example, in the 19th century, I know that we're using a lot of historical examples, but I think they're quite illustrative. Rancière talks about the way in which he studied, after he kind of made a split with Althusser, he spent a number of 7 or 8 years kind of delving in the archives and documents and letters that were written between workers in the 1820s and 30s, trying to get back in touch with the way in which workers reached some new type of subjectivity, essentially created this idea of a proletariat, because he'd already broken with this idea that there were intellectuals who could explain to the workers what their proper place was. he felt that the workers had realized themselves, and that was what made it political. So he looked at the way in which, first of all, you had capitalists, or the state at that time, that were understanding a worker to just be this important element in the unfolding progress of 19th century progress. But they had their part to play like everyone else, and they just had to work. But then he looked at the way that, that certain socialists and certain socialist movements were saying that workers were vital to another type of process, which was historical materialism. So both of them, they had their roles in both. But in both, they were unarticulate. They couldn't communicate themselves. They had no way of expressing themselves in any other way other than that determination had been given. So Rancière found all of these ways in which workers were mobilizing in the evening, in the nighttime. So his thesis was called The Knights of Labor. And the idea was that during the day they worked and they were workers, but at nighttime, in this kind of subterranean, imperceptible way, workers were organizing newspapers amongst themselves. They were writing poetry, they were writing books, they were writing novels, which the socialists thought was just petty bourgeois effect. And the capitalists didn't really mind as long as it didn't interfere with their work productivity. But this was the moment in which, for Rancière, workers were emancipating themselves. It was when they were asserting their intelligence. And they were asserting their equality as human beings who had intelligence. So the idea of universal equality has to be disentangled from some kind of liberal democratic idea of equality as a potential, or as something that we can rectify, that we live in a world that is assumed to be unequal or unequal, and that the role of liberals is to try and address that inequality, which is based, in Rancière's understanding, is based on this persistent creation of some kind of timeline in which there's regress and there's progress. So making somebody more equal is essentially helping them to catch up. So if they're not catching up, they're not progressing, they're regressing. So if they're not following particular procedures and trying to educate themselves in certain ways, trying to improve themselves in certain ways, then they're just being irrational and illogical and stupid. And that's where they're cut off, and their potential is cut off. And again, the political moment, the disruption, is when some kind of third way is created. So on this timeline, which is forward or backwards, there's this break out of it. And I don't have a nice slide, but if you could imagine a line and this big thing of lightning through it, that's the political moment. And that political moment, again, for Rancière, is about asserting a different time and space. I mean, that different time and space could be, you know, a geographical thing, but it's more a different type of time. So, for example, you know, we have an idea we live in a certain modern period that's gone through a certain amount of progress. A different type of political assertion would be that no, we don't have to refer all the time to that model of what is proper modernity. We can live in this and not be told we're traditional and backward. We can have a mix of those different things. As a small example. So maybe one more thing about equality is that, and I think I've said it, but equality isn't about some kind of objective equality. It's about the equality of a capacity for intelligence, and that can be asserted in infinite different ways. It's equality in difference, essentially. It's exactly not equality as equality or homogeneity. So I'll pass you back to.
So equality, as Buddy says, is not. Is the rupture in the chain of affiliation with all those categories of the state of the situation. So here relies the very notion of equality also in Badiou, which is not a program, is not a bureaucratic model, and is not a form of state. It corresponds rather to a departure, to something that is declared in the art of the emancipatory moment and that has to be maintained in all circumstances. So the problem is not for everyone to be equal, but you will ask, equal to who? But to become another. As Badiou says, with philosophical precision to be equal to one's own infinite as well as unconscious becoming others. So we are all the same, like our equality is our possibility of becoming something else. It's the possibility of a worker to become a poet. It's the possibility of improving for everyone. So this makes us the same. And I believe this is quite important because every call for an identity, and now there are many calls for identity, works directly against political emancipation. And it results in catastrophic statements like an homosexual can understand what an homosexual is, for example, or just an Arab understand what it means to be Arab, or as someone said in the last session, just a working class person can understand what it means to be working class. So we have to oppose the dominant idea that politics represents objective groups, or that is the result of objective conditions of historical, cultural, or economic nature. Because our aim, in the end, is to be rivals to capital and marry reacting against it, you know? And if state and capitalism are not sources of politics, because they are just structural things, they have no subjectivity, then every true subjectivation, every true political movement must proceed from nothing, in a certain way, from the void that is created by an event, from that situation, from an open situation, not from a closed situation. So politics doesn't start when we try to represent the oppressed, like we are the party of the working class or I don't know what, but when we engage with the events in which the oppressed take the initiative, like in the banlieue, like when the workers start to abandon factories or to write poems instead of doing something else. So at the moment, the best sign that I see in the actual situation is the composition of all coordinates, neoliberalism, the left, and all this stuff has to crumble down, in fact. But this won't come from a sort of reconstruction of the working classes. This is impossible at the moment. The only working class radicalization I see around Europe at the moment is a fascist radicalization, is a really racist radicalization. It's really dangerous. So it would be really naive now to fall in an utopian, mechanistic conception of the revolution. And we have no idea what the future model of organization will be. Like, there is no solution, no easy solution. But I think this is a false problem, because following Badiou's ideas, I think that organization cannot be taught as a substance. Organization should develop around the fact that there is always an excess, there is always a surplus of potential, which cannot be included in the state's representation. Like, that's not everything. And this excess corresponds to our subjectivity, which is more than our identity and is more than our culture, and corresponds also to our thought that is every time more, something more in surplus in relation to our knowledge. But it corresponds also to unexpected situation, to passionate declaration, encounters, affinities. The comrades of the invisible collective say, from now on, all friendship is political. Certainly, we can't rely on a revolutionary identity. In the present situation, the revolutionary identity corresponds to non-identity, as we have seen, to the continued betrayals of the predicates that we are submitted to, including those of identification with labor. Emancipation politics, for Badiou, is not one of the terms of social contradiction, but is the fact in itself that there is contradiction, that there is a surplus to the logic of the state and to the logic of capital. So the emancipatory we have to create is not an isolated we, the we of a closed group, but is rather the we of a position, because the front line passes through every one of us. So we have to consult that part of our desire that normalization didn't colonize yet and try to give it a collective consistency. This is the only guarantor of what Badiou calls the communist hypothesis, that is the anticipated certainty of an entirely different state of affairs, a new joyful intensity of existence. But to achieve it, it is necessary to abandon those decomposing organizations of the life that survive just because they struggle for self-preservation. Like they just adapt reality to their own ideology, to their own culture. They do the same thing that the state do, you know? Instead of organizing around the emergence of the new, the emergence of the evil. So the end of this left parties, decadent left parties in Europe, correspond to a radical opening of, to the event. It is that around those points that the hegemonic discourse, left, right, no matter, regards as impossible and unattainable, is around those things that subjectivities have to come together and to learn how to cooperate with each other. We have to create, and this is the end, I just quote Badiou, a new trend of politics beyond the domination of social, national, economic, and racial places, beyond gender and religion, and essentially displaced communists of the singularities with absolute equality as a point of departure.
So I'm going to talk about a few of those things, but I was thinking of maybe talking about them in a more specific way, although certainly in a pretty sketchy way, about the Zapatistas in Mexico, just because it's something that I find that there's some qualities of that, not to say that they're definitive or anything, but there's qualities of what happened in 1994 that possibly many of you know about, that I think are quite, they're certainly positive and I find quite inspiring, but they also echo a lot of what Ranciere and Badiou talk about in terms of the politics, the political and what politics and subjectivity might mean, you know, in the future. And you may know Zapatista was a revolution that was carried out in an area called the Chiapas in Mexico, a mountainous region, in on the 1st of January 1994, in which a number of indigenous communities rose up against the Mexican state just before the NAFTA agreement was signed between Mexico, America, and Canada. And at the time, it was really quite radical. It was 94, it was the demise of international socialism, for the Soviet Union, and so on, and this bunch of essentially peasants had come out of the mountains and challenged the Mexican army, as well as this new global capitalist agenda, and there's a lot of focus on perhaps the novelty of what happened there, of the uniqueness of it, and of the kind of the almost caricature of Subcomandante Marcos, who was the leader who had come down from Mexico City, who was this intellectual who'd met these peasants and had lived with them for 10 years before, you know, being a large part in leading this revolution. And there's a focus on the fact that the importance of the geography and the culture and the traditions to the revolution, and how that fed that revolutionary discourse, how important that was. But I think that the most amazing thing about it is partly, as we spoke about these hybrid relationships, the way in which Marcos and a group of people came down from Mexico City. They didn't speak the same language as these indigenous communities. But rather than there being this great difference and one type of abstract intellectual discourse having nothing to do with peasants and their religion and their connection to place, they had mutual understanding. They could share things, share experiences, and ultimately through their relationship create this incredible occasion. But it was after that Marcos and the army and the leadership talked about and have talked about the way in which the Zapatista revolution wasn't against the Mexican state and wasn't trying to claim power. It was simply the assertion of a people who didn't want to move, who didn't want to be thrown into the dustbin of history, who didn't want to be caught up in the progress of neoliberalism. And he spoke about how Zapatistas were everybody. Zapatistas were single women on a bus late at night who felt threatened by, you know, a couple of men. Zapatistas were homosexuals in Nairobi or wherever. It was everybody who felt as if they were repressed, determined, ascribed, given a certain role that they couldn't break through, couldn't express their imagination, the impossible. And so I think that's very important in terms of, it's not that you go out and find a new Indios people, a new Chiapas, and recreate it, or you don't go out and try and find another actor and go through this whole process, as Alessandro talked about victimization and pathos, and, oh, here's another poor oppressed people, we've got to help them out of it. It's rather the idea of trying to cultivate this, I think this idea of a universality, this idea of creating hybrids, of breaking with these orders which try and make this distribution between different peoples, different groups, and increasingly it happens. This way in which our lives are differentiated, that we're kept away from one another, not allowed to share our common experience. And the important thing is that with the Zapatistas is that there was a moment which was objective. The NAFTA agreement was signed, but what happened wasn't a reaction against NAFTA so much as the positive assertion of an alternative. It was an alternative which was strong and collective and had a huge amount of imagination, essentially, this dynamic behind it. And it's that kind of potential force which you can't determine, you can't label and just have it. And it's that kind of potential which takes a long time to build up and takes a lot of time and effort. And it's not the cynical pathos of the left, which is always this reactionary type of language and ideology, which doesn't have any desire to look at that potential which could create a moment like Zapatista or anything else. It's only interested in undermining and critiquing and digging out more and more. And that's what I'd like to leave you with.
Great, thanks a million.
Thanks, man.
I'll just ask anybody if they want to make a comment or ask a question, just stick around. Or fire ahead.
There is a second recording of the questions and answers that followed this session. That was about 30 minutes long. It'll be posted as a comment on the Indie Media article this was originally posted to, which you'll also find it at anarchism.pageabode.com. The recording and editing was done by Andrew Flood. You'll find more articles and also more recordings I've done at anarchism.pageabode.com/user/AndrewNFlood.